This episode of Movies With is brought to you by Aonix, a leading supplier of professional audiovisual equipment. For more information, visit aonix.co.uk. That's aonix.co.uk. Welcome to another episode of Movies With. I'm Jeff Sherman, here with my partners Norma Garcia and Rich Reed. In the studio with us today is a marvelous actor, director, podcast host, and entrepreneur whom I have known and adored since she was 12 years old. Danielle turned a one-off guest role on Boy Meets World into one of the most beloved and iconic characters ever on TV, Topanga Lawrence. Let's welcome Danielle Fishel.
I was a screenwriter for a long time, and there was a producer who called me in. He said, I've got this new show. It's called The Ben Savage Project. So he goes, it's Fred Savage's younger brother, and will you take a look at it and see if you want to be on staff? So I went in, and I got a job. They offered me the job. The show eventually became called Boy Meets World. And we had cast someone to play this, a young girl. She was probably 12 or 13, and we had cast her to play this sort of new-agey, hippie kind of girl, because our main character, Corey Matthews, Ben Savage, was sort of an everyman, kind of a down-to-earth guy, you know, grounded. We thought it'd be fun to bring in somebody completely, as, you know, probably for an episode or two. We went around the room and named her Topanga. So we cast someone, she came in, and we watched the first rehearsal, and it wasn't going right. And there was another little actress on the set, a little 12-year-old girl, had a couple lines. We'd all seen her, and she was kind of standing out. And the director came, and we all talked about it. In walks Danielle Fishel, who became Topanga, made it much more, and it went from being like just a little one-off kind of character to becoming one of the major romantic leads on a series ever. Here she is. Sorry, I got very emotional.
Thank you, Jeff.
I think what you brought to it that we didn't anticipate was it was a grounded, centered woman, which is Danielle, and always was since you were 12. She's always had that ability. So, what was your background getting into acting prior to Boy Meets World? What were you doing before that?
I was really just living a very normal 10-year-old girl life in Orange County. I was in gymnastics. I went to gymnastics, and I had good friends in my elementary school. I had done one play. I had been in The Wizard of Oz in elementary school. But there was a girl who was a couple years older than me who I thought just was the cat's pajamas. She was beautiful. She was smart. And one day she just came to school and she said, guess what? Yesterday I got an agent and I'm going to be a model. And I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do. If that's what you're going to do, that's what I want to do. And I went home and my mom so kindly and gently said to me, Danielle, height does not run in the family. And unfortunately, one of the things you need to really make it as a model is being taller than 5 feet. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's it. And I thought, there was my dream. Oh, well. So I went to school the next day and I told her that. I said, you know, I told my mom I wanted to be a model and she said that you have to be tall. And she said, oh, yeah, that is true. And she said, well, my agent's also going to put me on TV and I don't think you have to be tall to be on TV. And that's all I needed to know.
No way.
That was literally it. I was like, that's it.
That was your end. That's what I want to do.
I said, great. Short people can do it too. So, and that was literally it. Then for a year, I kept saying, I want to be on TV. I want to be on TV. And my parents, neither of them had worked in the entertainment industry. Right. They didn't know the first thing about getting into the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. They also had only heard horror stories about children in the entertainment industry. So they were very concerned and also thought, sure, you think that now, but you have no idea what it means. You don't know what auditioning is like. And and finally, after a year of begging, my mom and my dad looked at each other and they said, all right, let's let her go on a couple of auditions. She'll hate it, and then we'll be done with this ask. At least then we will have let her try.
Right.
And so my mom literally bought a book on like how to get your kid into the entertainment industry. And she read it, and there was a list of agents in the book. And it said, if you want to try to get an agent, take pictures of your child or yourself and send them into these places. Tell them what, you know, your stats. Yep. And then maybe if you hear back from any of them, it'll work out. And so we sent in pictures of me, normal snapshot pictures my mom took with a film camera. She sent them into like 10 different agents, and we heard back from like six or seven.
Wow.
And so we picked three. We make a joke that it's a running thing in my family. If you ever need work done, you get three estimates and you go with the middle. So they did a very similar thing. They picked three randomly from the people who wrote to us, and we went on those three meetings, and we signed with an agency. And I started doing commercials.
And did you have to do a scene for them? Or what did it entail getting an agent at that point?
They did have me do a scene, but it was mostly just a conversation. They had me walk in, sat down, and then they just talked to me about, tell me about school and tell me about your friends. And they got a sense of my personality. And so why do you want to do this?
Okay.
And then they
so did. Just being more natural. And how old were you at this time?
I was 10.
Okay, so 10.
Wow.
Okay.
And then they did have me do a scene. And I think it was more of a commercial. I think it had me do like a commercial scene. And then they said, we'd love to get her into a commercial workshop class. So that was my very first ever experience for learning how to slate, learning how to meet and talk to casting directors. My very first audition was for Mattel. We were so excited, and we drive to, you know, we're coming from Orange County. My mom picks me up from school, and we drive in this horrendous traffic to get to this Mattel commercial. And I go in, and I do the audition, and there's tons of kids. It's like a cattle call, basically. Yeah. And I come out, my mom goes, how did it go? And I said, great. I got it.
Oh, they told you right there and then.
That's what she said. She said, they told you that? And I said, no, they didn't tell me that. I just know it.
Danielle, I love it.
And my mom, her whole heart and stomach and everything sank. And she went, we did not prepare her. We did not prepare her for this.
Yeah, yeah.
She's going to think she did well, and she's not going to get it. So she went home, and she talked to my dad, and they had this whole conversation. You know, Danielle, I'm so glad it went so well and that you felt so good. But, you know, you're going to get this whole process is going to be lots of auditions, and you're going to be told no a lot more often than you're going to be told yes. And so that doesn't mean that you were bad. And it was like, no, it's cool. It's fine. I got it. And then the next day, we found out I got a call back. My mom was like, okay. You did get a call back. That is, you are in the right direction. And I did end up booking the audition.
So you
and
knew.
I just knew it.
And what was it that you knew? Was it a response from them, or just you felt?
Yes, there was a visceral response from them. I felt very much like I read what they wanted that was on the page. Nice. I did what they wanted that was on the page. And then I saw them. There was like, I remember them looking at each other like, wow, yeah,
right?
She was great.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, of course, over the years, you have many of those experiences where you don't even end up getting the call back.
Right.
This one, though, I did. I was just like, yeah, I for sure. So I, yeah, same.
Well, it's a thing that actors don't know. I always tell young actors when they ask me what advice. Everybody in that room is waiting for Danielle to walk in. You know, you're waiting for that right person that fits that role. And because, you know, I'm sure on the other side of it, you're thinking like, this is horrible. It's like a shooting gallery and I'm going in and they're going to whatever. We're all going like, please be the
Everyone's
one. Please be
voting
the one.
For
yeah,
you.
They want that actor so they can move on the list.
So if you know that in your head, you can come in with a little more confidence and just give it your best.
They're rooting for you.
Right.
They want you to succeed. They're not rolling their eyes at you before you've opened your mouth.
We're not making notches on our scripts.
Yeah, exactly. How were your parents when you got your first?
I mean, they were thrilled.
Yeah.
They were like, wow, this feels crazy and very excited for me. And they were very supportive. I did do that commercial and then I did another one. And then I did multiple, like from that first Mattel commercial, I was kind of in with Mattel. And so I ended up getting to do like four or five Mattel commercials for them. I still auditioned for them, but it was a little bit more of a fast track. Like I was going straight to producers on.
Okay.
It's Danielle on The Usual Suspects.
I mean, as a kid to do a Mattel commercial, tell me that there was like some toys involved and some.
Oh yeah, and it was always very fun. The clothes were always great. My actual first commercial was for a doll that sounds terrifying when I say it now, but there were three dolls and they all did something slightly different. One had braided hair and you could pull her hair from the back of her head and then you had fake scissors and it looked like you were cutting her hair.
Okay.
The other doll had a fake ice cream cone, and when you put the ice cream cone to her mouth, it left an ice cream ring around her mouth. And mine had a button you pushed at the top of her head and her first two teeth grew. And literally my first line ever on national television was, look, she's getting her first teeth. And I squeal, teeth. And they wanted me to do it that way. I remember the day of being like, higher, higher. Really squeak out that teeth. And so look, she's getting her first teeth. And here we are. The rest is history.
I know. Exactly.
So you did the commercials for a while. And then what was the evolution from there? Did you do plays?
I never did plays. I did those commercials. And then I booked Full House. Then I'd done enough commercials, or I'd done a few commercials, I started getting auditions for TV shows.
Okay.
And actually, the first TV show I did was Harry and the Hendersons. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have a speaking part. I was just a featured guest star, mm-hmm. basically, where they opened up.
Is that the one with the
yes,
the tall creature
monster looking guy? Yeah.
John Lithgow, was it John Lithgow?
He was on the show, I think, but not.
I don't remember the show.
I don't remember it either, to be honest.
Sort of like a Bigfoot.
Bigfoot. Yeah. And there was a young boy on the show who I played like a girl that somehow he had a crush on, and at the very end of the episode, he opened the door, and I was just standing on the other side of the door, and I like waved to him, and it was just a cute mm-hmm. little thing. I didn't even say anything. But then after that, I booked Full House.
You did have lines on that.
And I did have lines on that, and that was very fun. And it was my first live studio audience.
I was going to say, that right there must have been a very different experience.
Yeah,
from commercials to going to live studio audience.
Yeah, and commercials you shoot in one day,
right, exactly.
Maybe 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And now I was there for all 5 days. Mm. I was there for table read. I got to see this whole process. Not to mention, Full House was such a massive show.
Exactly.
I was such a fan. I'm meeting all these like real celebrities, mm-hmm. and they were all so sweet. Everybody was very welcoming. And, you know, working with Rich Carell, directed my first episode.
Great.
It's just an absolute legendary TV mm-hmm. director. And it was great. And
so you were how old at this point?
I was 11.
So 11.
Yeah.
Oh,
so then at 11, I get to do Full House, and I played one of Stephanie's little friends, but kind of an antagonistic friend, a friend who was like, oh, your ears aren't pierced? Everybody has pierced ears.
Oh, and so a little bit of a sassy friend
mm-hmm. who kind of made her feel bad about herself and then convinced her to pierce her ears. So that was my first studio audience, which mm-hmm. was also like a whole different ballgame.
That must have been just that.
Exhilarating.
Ugh. Yeah.
And I'm also thinking about your parents who are like, all right, she's on to something if she's got a else now.
Yes, absolutely. And so then they were like, I mean, really pretty quickly after I started booking commercials, they were like, oh, okay, I guess.
This is it. This is
yeah, I guess
thing.
This is it. Yeah.
And your mom, you know, when you're that age, your mom has to be on set all the time, right?
Yeah. Thankfully for my mom, and I truly don't know how parents do it when both parents are working. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And so as difficult as it still was because I had a younger brother, and unfortunately his life now just became being shuttled around in a car with me. I think truthfully it was hardest on him because he's like, well, now this is your life.
Right. It's all about Danielle.
It's all about Danielle now. And we have to spend an hour and a half in traffic one way.
Did it cause
talking about Danielle?
For you
guys?
Not between us, but it was hard on him. Mm-hmm. Especially then once I got Boy Meets World and I was mm-hmm. recognized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we would, go to dinner for his birthday.
Oh.
And there'd be a line of kids who wanted an autograph.
From you.
For me.
On his birthday.
How did your parents, I mean, obviously you're 12 years old, so you're young. How did your parents keep you grounded? Because it must be very difficult. Because even as an adult, when you've got, all of a sudden, your life just changes overnight, it is hard to keep yourself grounded. It must be even harder mm-hmm. when you're that much younger.
Yeah, well, one of the really good things they did was they still made me pick up dog poop all the time.
You had house chores.
100%.
Okay,
I had house chores, and I had to do them.
Yep.
And my parents were never on me about my professional life and the obligations I had with work. They knew that the adults I worked with, that was their responsibility to make sure, I was showing up knowing my lines. They didn't have to stay on me about that. They stayed on me about real life stuff. Are you doing your schoolwork? Are you maintaining normal friendships with the people you go to school
nice.
With?
Mm.
Are you making your bed, and are you picking up the dog poop? And if for even 1 second you give me any attitude, I will find more chores for you to do, and you will go do them right now. I also was very fortunate in the sense that I was not the breadwinner for our family. My parents never took any income from the money that I made. My dad made a living, and that's how they supported the family. So my mom was very quick to say, the second this isn't fun for you anymore and that you don't want to do this anymore, truthfully, it'll make my life easier. Your brother's life would be easier. Like, you're not doing us any favors by doing this. So we are here to support you as long as you want to do this. But when you no longer want to do it, we will take you out of it so fast your head will spin. So if there was any bit of attitude or like, my mom's like, hey, not doing this for me. You're not doing this for me.
Is that a sign?
Is that a sign? Because I'm ready. I'm looking for anything I can.
That's really smart.
That's a lot. Yeah, it is smart. That is smart. But that also puts the responsibility on you and you taking ownership of like, all right, this is serious.
Yeah.
If I'm going to do this, this is serious, right?
And the importance of, and it's something I try to already do with my kids, my mom reminding me of that was really good for me to always be in touch with, am I enjoying this?
Yeah.
Is this what I want? Like, keeping myself in check for who am I doing this for?
Mm-hmm.
And the second it wasn't fun for me anymore, I did stop acting.
Yeah.
But I loved every single
Did
second
you?
Of it. Yeah, when we were on Boy Meets World. I mean, I literally was the only thing I wanted to do was just go to work every single day.
We had a blast. It was
so much fun. And every episode I wasn't in was such a bummer.
So, Danielle, tell me your experience when you got the gig from your lens as a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Like when you were going through the audition and they said yes. What was going through your head and how did you feel?
Well, they didn't say yes at the audition.
Oh.
So I got the audition for Topanga and I went and the other thing I'll say is the reason I had done so many commercials and that I had done that episode of Full House was because the characters I had booked were mostly just similar to Danielle. Young, bubbly, fast-talking. She's getting her first teeth. That's not far from who Danielle is.
Got it.
And so I had taken only that commercial workshop class. I had not necessarily taken acting classes.
Okay.
So I didn't know that you could act, that you could be someone that you were not. I would just read things that were on the page and think, well, how would Danielle say this? I would just then say them. So I went in and I read for, as Jeff described, this flower child with hippie parents who spoke very slowly and was very, different, marched to the beat of her own drum. And I read it the way you would if you were doing a Mattel commercial. And so they said, thank you very much. Have a nice day. And I left and I did not get a call back. But the next day I got an audition to play a different character on Boy Meets World. So same show, different character. And this character had a couple of lines and was much more Danielle adjacent. Okay. And I did book that role. And they cast another young woman to play Topanga. And when I showed up to work that day, that very first day on a Friday, and I watched the director, David Trainer, work with her, that was my first acting class. It was literally the first acting class I had ever been a part of. And it was like light bulbs going off. Hearing the way he was saying, slow down here, say it like this, try this. And her trying and adjusting and going, listening to what he had to say and then doing something differently. And then saying, I didn't feel good about that. Let's do that again. And I was like, you can do that. And I had that little feeling you get when you're like, can I try again?
The light bulb went
I want to try again. I get it now. I see. And all I could think of was, I see why I did not get a callback. I can hear my own audition. And now I'm thinking all the things I did wrong. And you don't ever think you get another chance for that.
No.
But at the end of that day, then, they did let go that other girl. It wasn't working out with her. And they said, Danielle and Marla, these other two girls who had this role with these two couple of lines, we're going to re-audition you. And all of a sudden, I was like, I get the chance, a second chance to do the thing. And thankfully, I had been paying attention to what the director wanted, and I knew exactly what he wanted. And so I went in there, and that audition I nailed. But I still didn't think I got it. So unlike the Mattel commercial where I had so much false confidence that then turned out to be real confidence, I walked out of this one and said, I didn't get
it. Why? What was that voice? What was it?
Other girl who was reading for it, Marla Sokoloff, who's gone on to have an incredible career, she had gone in first. And when she was leaving, she lived up north. So she lived in like Northern California. And because it was a Friday and we weren't coming back to work until Monday, she was going back home to be with her family. And our casting director, Sally Steiner, needed to make sure she could get in touch with her. You know, realize this is 93. This is before the age of like too much, you know, cell phone.
Yeah, nobody had cell phones.
No cell phones. Just like, where are you going? What's your manager's name and number? What's your pager? How can I get in touch with you? The minute her audition was over, Sally was like, I need every way to get a hold of you over this weekend as possible. And I could also hear Marla's audition, and I thought Marla's audition had been really good. And then when I finished my audition, they were like, okay, bye. We'll see you later. And that was it. And so we got in the car, and we had one of those Zach Morris cell phones that you had to pay giant car phones, they called them. They were not cellular phones. They were car phones. Mm-hmm. And it was like $8.99 a minute to talk to somebody. And my dad had been paging my mother, like 911, because at this point, our workday was significantly over. He was expecting us to have come home a lot earlier. This audition took place after. My mom hadn't had a chance to fill him in yet. So he was worried about us. So we get in the car, and I instantly burst into tears. And my mom goes, call your father. Tell him we're on your way home. So I call my dad, and I'm like, so anyway, I'm at work. And blah. He's like, okay, hold on. There's a call waiting. And then he comes back to the car phone, and he goes, that was some woman named Sally Steiner who told me to tell you to show up on Monday as Topanga. And none of it made sense to my dad because I hadn't even gotten to that part of my day yet. He was like, none of it made sense to him. He just took the message, and my mom could hear it through the Zach Morris phone. And I looked at her, and with tears streaming down my face. And then we both just screamed bloody murder. And it was just the best.
What did you learn from that experience? Because here you were following your intuition, you were studying the room, and here, like, well, I didn't get any signals.
Yeah, I didn't get any of those signals. And I had already been rejected for it once.
Right.
So there was a sense of, well, I wasn't right the first time. I studied today, but I certainly didn't study with the anticipation that maybe I'd ever get another chance. But now I do have this other chance, and it's with this other girl who already was pretty well established. She had been working for years as a child actor.
Yes.
And so I just had this insecurity that it wasn't going to be me.
There you go.
And then it was, and it was.
All right, there's a couple of questions for you. So you turn up on Monday. Mm-hmm. How did that feel? You must have felt
amazing. A champion.
You know. I did, but I was also very nervous, and it's also a little bit awkward because Marla and I had totally bonded on that Friday, and our moms had spent time with each other, and now this girl who on Friday was going to be my friend all week because we were playing friends on the show, I'm now like, is she mad at me?
Oh, yes.
And so there's a little bit of that awkwardness.
Was she cool?
She was totally cool.
Yeah, okay.
Marla was great.
She's a sweetheart. She's a
very sweet girl. And so it was fine, but there was a little bit of that awkwardness. And then also, like, someone's already been fired from this part.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so getting fired is a thing that can happen. And I am a product of it. And so there was always that sense of, this is mine now, but it doesn't mean I'm going to have it forever.
No, but you had the forethought to look and learn when you saw the director with the previous actress,
That's important. You
were watching what they were doing because you
wanted it.
And it does. It speaks a lot to your character, as in you personally, as opposed to the person you play.
You're studying. You're learning. You're wanting to learn.
I was, and I was always a sponge. And that is one thing I always heard as a kid was you take direction well, and I did. I was able to listen and process, and then deliver something else. I went through that Monday thinking, this is great. I feel pretty good. I feel pretty confident. I knew the director was happy with me because the director had felt, you know, had given me that vote of confidence on Friday, you know, to even bring me into the audition. And so I knew he was pretty happy. But then we had to do a run through. So then on Monday, we have to do a run through in front of all of the writers and in front of the executive producer. And then we got notes. And this was, you know, the run through and note process on Full House was nothing like.
I think Michael Jacobs is unique in that.
He is. He's unique in that way that
long,
the notes
sessions
are like 2 hour notes.
Where they would normally be how long?
30 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's a session.
Yeah. And there's, you know, I mean, it really is, we joke, but it really was page one, line one, wanting to go through what everybody said and why they were saying it, intention behind it. And in a lot of ways, I owe him all the credit for the reason why I know how to break down a script. Even now as a director, the reason I'm so efficient at what I do is because I know how to open a script and how to break it down and find the jokes and find the moments and possibly find jokes and moments that weren't necessarily intended, but that I can bring out in with, you know, through an actor or through a comedic beat with blocking or something like that. And I know how to do that because Michael taught us that in the way he talked about scripts. Yes. We got to learn about that process because he was very open with it. He never tried, there was no gatekeeping when it came to the process of writing the script, what he was thinking about and how he was building the universe and why. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's intimidating, especially at 12.
Yeah.
So he treated the children actors like adult actors.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is amazing because you learn a lot faster that way. Do.
Well, can be rough too.
Can be rough, yeah.
No, I understand that. So to my next question. So it must be hard because you're getting a lot of adulation and fame from 0 to 100 in seconds. So you've got that to contend with. Plus you're growing up. You're a normal, you're a teenager. I mean, that must have been, I suppose, a mix of emotions you must have had when you were on set, being a teenager growing up, going through all the pains and experiences, the pain, the pleasure of being a teenager, plus you add fame into that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think kids today, it's a totally different thing because fame feels much more tangible. Mm. At the time, Boy Meets World, when I had done the fourth episode, I don't even know if Boy Meets World had aired yet. The first episode may have just aired by the time we were filming my episode. It wasn't like, well, you're walking onto a famous show. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that yet. None of the people that I went to school with really cared too much about what I was doing. So thankfully, at that time, I didn't feel the weight of the world of like fame and success on my shoulders. But I certainly knew this is a make or break opportunity. This is my first ever job that really is entirely about my character. Almost the entire episode was about Topanga and her. And
oh, so you were constantly reading.
I was very heavy in the script, and I had to do a dance number that I had to choreograph myself. That was like interpretive dance. I do know it still, and I had to talk very slow. And I, as you have probably gathered, I don't usually talk slow.
Like, so you had to train. So you had to go through some personal training to slow down.
Yes, that's big time. Big time. My mom and I stayed up on that first night. So Monday night, we do the run through. And that night, I get notes, you know, tomorrow, Danielle, you need to do this entirely differently.
Oh,
you did not nail it. This was not what we wanted for the character. This is not what we wanted from the performance. And I'm going to save all of your notes until the end so that the rest of these people don't have to sit and listen to all the things I have to say to you. So then I sat there for the 2 hours with tears just on the edge of my eyelids, just trying to make it through the rest of the note session. And then he pulled my mom and I into the kitchen set and opened up the script and went through everything and told every single line what he wanted from everything. And my mom took notes and I kind of just sat there and listened. And we went home that night. We ate dinner together as a family. And then my mom and I stayed up until about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
No way.
And just went over my lines and said them over and over again. And my mom, when she didn't know what else to say, my mom's not an acting teacher. My mom's she just had the notes and she knew what Michael said. And she just, anytime I would say something, she would just say back to me, "Great. Now do it even slower." And I was like, oh my gosh, I felt like I was talking like molasses. To me, it just felt like, how could anyone talk so slow? But he had made it so clear that he really wanted her to be slow. And so we worked on it till, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I went to sleep. I had to be at work at 7:30, 8 a.m. the next day to do school. We started rehearsal usually around 9 or 10, but school was before then. And so I slept for a couple hours. My mom and I drove to Burbank and we did another day. And then we had another run through that night. And unlike the day before, where I was, you know, not necessarily wasn't given a whole lot of praise. On this night in particular, Michael stood up and he gave me a standing ovation, and all the writers joined him and stood up, and he said that the turnaround that you have done between yesterday and today, and the work that you have put forward into what you were able to accomplish today, and he, you know, just very effusive about how, what a wonderful job I had done.
So, I can imagine. So today, in today's world, you know, people don't take criticism maybe so easily, or constructive criticism, I should say. Because, you know, at 12, you know, someone to turn around and say to you, look, you made you sit there for 2 hours and then turn around to you and say, didn't like that, you need to do it better. Yeah. You've got to be a certain type of character to be able to take that on the chin, brush yourself off and do it again.
Yes.
As a kid, even.
It's hard enough as an adult.
Hearing you speak like that, I have to put myself in the lens. You are working at a corporate company, right? Your boss doesn't like it. You have to come back. You pull an all-nighter.
Yeah.
And you were like 12 years old.
Yeah. But then the worst part of all of it is you have to go the whole day rehearsing it and waiting. Because, by the way, the person who has been unhappy with you is not there during the rehearsal. Right. Yeah. So you're like, I would like even just a little bit of, hey, I think you're on the right track, but you don't know. You're getting it from the director, but the director was not the person who had necessarily said he had the problem with me. It's, you know, I have to wait to do this run through, to do this performance, and then the performance anxiety that kicks in right before, and you go, well, now that I'm nervous and my adrenaline is pumping, what's my natural inclination?
Yeah, exactly.
Race through everything. Yeah. And thankfully, I think he told me at least, I don't remember the performance at all.
I
truthfully,
do
you?
It was like we were worried the first night just because we just didn't know. And she came back. It was like magic. And we all wanted her to have it, you know.
What were the writers like?
She did the work.
The writers were wonderful.
Tell us about the writers.
What is she going to say?
Tell us about one in particular.
No, they really were. And the guys that I've worked with who were, you know, for obvious reasons, a 16-year-old boy had a reason to be closer to Jeff Sherman than 12-year-old girl Danielle.
Right.
But it was one of our favorite things about being on the show was that Michael, none of the writers, none of the crew treated us like children except in all of the appropriate ways they should treat us like children. Mm-hmm. They protected us from the things we didn't need to know. Mm-hmm. They kept us protected from people around us who maybe didn't have, you know, if there was somebody who didn't know how to be appropriate on set, that person was let go of and never to be heard from again.
Right.
And so we felt we were very protected, and yet they were very open about, come to us with any questions. If you ever want to know anything, if there's anything we could ever help you with, if there's a way we could help you connect to your character more.
Yes.
And Jeff, especially with Ryder, was, you know, he was a mentor, and he was a person who Ryder felt very comfortable with going to him. And one of, I think, the reasons that that Sean character is as deep and wonderful is because of you and the relationship you had with Ryder.
And, you know, the other thing that was so special about our show, and you've been directing a lot, we'll get into that, but you've been directing a lot of the like Disney Channel type shows. And the parents on that show, all your parents, without a doubt, I'm not going to name one. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But every parent was so great. Like, they would sit in the bleachers while they were rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember, like, Ben's mom would just, like, if she saw, she would just get up and say, stop it, stop this now. Or they were always great. Your teachers were great. It was a really good environment. Like, you'll hear about a lot of the shows with kids on them where the kids ended up in jail or on drugs or something. All of them turned out, I mean, they're all wonderful, you know?
So, but you guys also nurtured that, it sounds like.
Yes.
Well,
we understood they were kids and you dealt with them as, you know, but respecting them as coworkers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I felt. And then, you know, with Ryder, you know, he came to me and wanted to know about writing, and I got to be friendly with Will because he was a little bit older than all you guys.
Yeah.
And Ben was my babysitter.
Yeah.
He's your babysitter.
Yeah. Ben Savage, the star of the show, came to me one day and he said, I just saw him the other day in the SAG picket line. And I reminded him, but he said, with Alex, actually, he said, Jeff, I need to make some more money because I want to start dating and stuff. I said, okay. He goes, I really like Alex. Can I babysit him? I'm thinking, like, I don't know if this is a good idea. I said, okay, sure. You know, and I asked his mom. She said, yeah, that's great. Because he wasn't, even though he was getting the most of any of the actor on the show except for Bill. I think he and Bill got the same amount.
Yeah.
His parents were very good with him, and he got a certain amount of allowance,
yeah,
and it wasn't really enough to, so he came and he did it, right? I go out with my then wife, and we come back at about 10 o'clock. His bedtime was 8 o'clock. I hear all this noise in the house going on. It's just, they're just, I realize I have two kids playing with no adults in the house.
What was the age difference?
He was wonderful. I mean, just all of them. I've been on a lot of projects and stuff, but there's a certain bond with the Boy Meets World people that just lingers, I think.
You certainly appear to have created like lifelong friendships.
Family, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, family. Yeah. And that must be special in itself because, formative years, you've all grown up together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was on the show from 12 to 19. Mm. So all of my teenage years were on that show with that group of people. And of course, you know, with that, there's some hardships. It's like sometimes people are there for an entire season and you love them and you are bonded with them. Mm-hmm. And then the season starts again and they're not back.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, where did my friend go?
Yeah.
And when will I see my friend again?
So you would just find out when you showed up?
Yeah.
Michael didn't tell you?
No.
Wow. That'd be difficult.
That's how we showed up to the table read it for season two and Lee Norris was gone. And we were like, well, and you can't ask. You feel like you can't ask. And, you know, at that point, I was even still not a series regular. And so you're just, you know, it's an odd thing to feel like your job security is kind of unknown. Mm. And then the people you are bonded with and become close to are also who knows where they're going to end up or what's going to happen to them. But yes, it's one of the reasons people who work in the industry flock to each other so much because it is unlike almost anything else. And we understand it. There's a shorthand with people who know the life that we live.
It's security you give each other, I would guess.
Yeah.
Support. It's a support because that is your, I mean, it's hard to, when you're in the industry, I mean, especially as an actor, but even just anyone in the industry, you dedicate so much time for the film, for the TV series, for the content that your coworkers are your family.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so and it becomes more than just a job. It's your personal life as well.
Yes. And one thing I'll say, too, is Michael really fostered an environment on set that was unlike other sets where there were children. The Boy Meets World set really was a family environment where professional work took place. And that was a conscious choice by Michael and the rest of the crew and the cast. People's wives were always there. Their children could come there on tape nights or even after a rehearsal. There were families around all the time. And on other sets where there were children, it was an adult working environment and there happened to be children around and whatever would happen in this work adult place environment where there were very few rules or very, you know, you think of like an adult workplace environment and you think of like a 9-to-5 or an office and you think, well, what bad could really go on there? And then you think, well, sets where there aren't necessarily, you know, people cursing and talking about what they got into last night and, you know, smoking, drinking, all that stuff, like taking place around children was the norm. And it was not the Boy Meets World set. It just wasn't. And so that added to the family atmosphere because our parents were all close and our teachers were involved in our lives. And, you know, when we did get into something we shouldn't get into, our teachers were on the phone with our parents and we were then.
At the bat phone.
Oh, number, yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
So you got to 19 and the series finished. Mm-hmm. So that was what, 2000?
Yeah.
Okay. So in 2000, what was your next step? What came next?
I was very, very burnt out when the show ended.
Oh, you were?
Understandably.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was 7 years is a long time.
Yeah.
Also, as a teenager, you don't know how rare what you've just gone through is. Also, having the luck that I had nailing my first commercial audition, rolling right into having a guest starring role on TV, then getting Topanga, who turned into being a series regular. Everything had come pretty easily. So I was just like, ugh, been this character for so long. I just want to like go do something else. Or even if I don't do anything, I had also was the only person who had been in school the entire time because I was the youngest person on the show. So like writer was done with high school for the last several years of the show and was able to take college courses, but it meant he was able to work full time and have a lot of downtime to do things that he chose to do. The entire 7 years of the show, I was working a 10 and a half hour workday and still taking high school exams and trying to go to high school dances and going to the high school football games and doing all that. So there was a part of me that just wanted a break. And it meant when the show ended, I was also graduating from high school. And it was like, I can do whatever I want to do with my time. And I also did not understand the striking while the iron was hot thing. Mm-hmm. I really was like, I just want to take a break. I don't want to do this anymore. And then by the time I was like, all right, I had a good 2 year break. I'm ready to jump back in.
I'm back.
Everyone's like, yeah, who cares? Are you? Who
did
cares?
Did you have problems being Topanga and so recognizable too? I mean, people get so set on you being Topanga.
They want you to be that role. Well, yes. And a large part of it was I would get asked to come into every room. I did not have a problem people wanted to see me. They were willing to take the audition. But then I would come in and I'd be so excited to like read for this role. And they'd spend 15 minutes just talking to me about what they loved about Boy Meets World. And then I'd realize like I'd start the audition and I could tell they were just like, I didn't really want to take you seriously for this. I wanted to meet you.
I'm a fan and wanted
to talk to you about the show.
Well, that would burn you out too. You'd stop wanting to go to audition.
And so then you feel like, it was hard. And I also feel like I should have, if I really wanted to be an actor and I was really going to take it very seriously, I should have in the summers and in the hiatuses from Boy Meets World been doing other things, whether that was plays, whether that was movie, just focusing on doing other roles. Mm-hmm. And I never did again, because this other life I had, which was a high school girl who wanted to go to prom and go to the high school football games, I wanted to go back to that. We would wrap in March and I'd get to go to school full time from March until June, which meant I got to pass notes to the boys in school and I got to see my girlfriends and go and watch them be cheerleaders at high school.
Did they treat you differently at school?
No.
That's great.
When I started in sixth grade with this, I went to A.E. Wright in Calabasas. Calabasas obviously has a large population of people who work in the entertainment industry. So they paired me with a girl. They basically paired me with a friend because I was new to the area and didn't know anybody. They paired me with a friend. And that girl happened to be Vanessa Evigan, who is also an actress. Her father was on My Two Dads. Mm-hmm. And so her job that was to like take me around the school and show me where things were. And I met this great group of friends in my sixth grade year. And we were friends. They are still my best friends today. They're the people that when I say I'm getting together with my girlfriends for lunch, it's those same girls that I've known since I was 12.
That's wonderful.
I was pretty much just like, oh yeah, Danielle, she works on that show. It's
so I know you did the talk show or the dish, was
the dish
it?
Yeah.
And was that soon after that, or
I was 26, 27 when I started the dish, so a full seven years.
So you did a couple movies in between.
Talk about those movies, Jeff.
We ignore that part.
Yeah. Okay. It was because that was the other thing that I'll say was hard. Topanga was such an incredible character. She was smart. She was a feminist. She was a good friend. She was a great girlfriend. She was then a wife. And she was all of these things that people could say men put up on a pedestal as being like the perfect woman. Yeah. She was virginal, but she was pretty. Like she was pretty much like, wow, if you're going to play a character, if you're going to play a female character on TV, you want it to be this one. All of the things people wanted me to do after were just the antithesis of that.
Really?
Just how do we, let's put her in this movie. And you see it with people who are on Disney Channel shows and then they become 18 and now they want to show everybody, I don't have to be that.
Well, I can do it. I can almost be
like the rebel.
Yes. I'm going to do the opposite of that just to show you my versatility.
Yeah. And you lose your audience.
Yeah. Exactly. You lose your audience and isolate the people who are like, hey,
that's too much.
Too much, too soon. You're still 18.
Yeah. Right.
And so I didn't do any of that early on. Mm-hmm. But then by the time it got to a point where it was like, okay, well, now I haven't worked for 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. I did not make enough money on Boy Meets World. I was never paid even a fraction of what the guys made.
After all those years?
None of them.
You're kidding.
Nope.
And it sounds like your role was a predominant role,
right? She was the second. It's Ben and you.
Yes. No, I think I was making half of what Ryder made at the start of season 5. And I never caught up to even making close to what anybody else made on the show. So it wasn't like I made so much money, and I wasn't even a series regular until season four.
That's so
wrong. It's not like I made enough money where it was like, well, it's okay. Even though you're going through your savings, you're going to be okay. At a certain point, I did actually need to say, well, I have to do something.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I did a couple of movies, nothing that was like that I need to be ashamed of, but just like not movies I love. But I did them because I thought, okay, at least it will give me something to do. It's a paycheck.
Right.
And I'll get out there. And then I got really tired of feeling like my entire career was in the hands of other people hoping they were willing to give me a job. Mm-hmm. And I said, what could give me this sense of confidence in my life? And the answer was, you need to find something else you love.
Mm.
If you know what else there is that you love and you can go and pursue that and still continue to pursue acting, you'll be happier. And so I went to school and I went to college and I studied psychology, and it was the greatest thing I could have ever done because I loved it. And I was like, that's it. I'm going to be a marriage and family therapist. Mm-hmm. And I was so much like Topanga through those years. I graduated with a 3.98 in psychology from Cal State Fullerton and got accepted for my master's degree at Chapman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right at the time that I had just enrolled in college that I got the call to audition for The Dish. And it was, they were talking about it as being the female The Soup, which had been hosted by Greg Kinnear way back in the day, but was currently being hosted by Joel McHale. And thankfully, I had watched every episode of The Soup, absolutely loved
yeah,
it, and was just excited
and
that
somebody—
you were
great on that, too. I remember thinking, I remember you told me you were on it, and I checked it out. You were great.
How long did you do that for?
Thank you. It was about 3 years, and it was so much fun. It was the only hosting thing I had ever done. It was so exciting to me that somebody was willing to see me and let me
be you,
be me, and have, you know, show my personality. And I got to work again very closely with a group of very funny writers who made me look very funny. And it was just a truly incredible experience, and I loved it. And I felt very much like, great, of course, the second I find this other thing, this— and that's one of the reasons why my advice to people whenever they ask me for, like, I'm an aspiring actor, I say, bear with me, this is going to sound like a buzzkill at first, but my best advice is find your plan B. But find your plan B that doesn't feel like, well, I guess I'll go do this.
Right.
Find your plan B that is, I love this, and if this doesn't work out for me, I will be thrilled to do this other thing too.
That's really—
because then it gave me confidence walking into a room. I didn't need the job. I didn't need it. I didn't have desperation about me. It was very much like, am I right for this or am I not?
Yeah,
we'll decide together.
That's a great attitude.
And it was, it was the best thing ever.
And then after a few more years, you went and did Girl Meets World, I guess was the next.
I had just been accepted to Chapman University for my
master's
degree. Literally
in
like
psychology.
The week before. Okay. Yeah. And I was just about to accept. And Michael called me. I don't even remember how I got this word from Michael that was like, Danielle, it's Michael. Call me. I need to talk to you. And it was like, what could this possibly be about? And he said, listen, I've got this idea. I want to talk to you about it. And I'll never forget him saying to me, listen, I don't want to do the show without you, but if I have to do the show without you, I'll do the show without you. And it was like, okay, I get it. I definitely did not want to make me feel like he needed me. Wanted me, but I don't need you.
Yeah.
And I was like, I get it. I don't know how I could say no to this.
Mm-hmm.
It's truly felt like a once in a lifetime opportunity to revisit a character I loved so much and would now get to imagine who would she have grown into as a wife and a mother. And I was not a wife or a mother yet myself at the time. So I had to envision.
Oh, and you had to play that role.
And I had to have to figure out what that means.
And then during Girl Meets World, you started directing. Is that when you started?
Yeah. So in the second season, and I can give Ben credit for that too, because I never, for as much confidence as I've had over the course of my life, I've never been the type of person to think like, oh, something totally different that I've never done before. I'm going to sign myself up. I think I should do that. I've just been like, yeah, I'm the actor here. That's my job.
Mm-hmm.
But Ben, going into the second season, and he it may have already been in his contract going into first season, but Ben put in his contract that he was going to get to direct. And we had like a Favored Nations contract.
Good.
Michael came to me and said, listen, Ben's going to direct an episode. you should direct an episode too. And I was like,
wow,
I've never.
He said you should direct an episode.
Well, yeah, he kind of had to because I had a favored nations contract. So they were going to have to give me the opportunity to do it anyway. And at first I was like, well, I'll just not do it. That's fine. I'd never thought about it, but I was like, oh, okay. And thankfully I didn't say like, no, I don't want to give mine to Ben. I just said, okay, all right, you know, thanks. And then I had just really been paying attention to, well, what does it mean to be a director? And I had thought of all of the things that were not camera oriented. Because the first thing I went to was, I don't know how to pick cameras and talk to the camera coordinator. And mm-hmm. I don't know anything about framing or lenses or any of that stuff. But when I would watch what the directors were doing, and I was then thinking about it through the lens of, could I see myself in that role? I realized, well, I already do a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. The young actors who were very green on the show and a very well-established director would want them to do something different, but instead of communicating it in a certain way, would probably just walk up and grab them by the arm and adjust them where they wanted them. And then they would walk away, and I would see the kid kind of look around like, huh, I wonder why they just did that. I would not step on anybody's toes there. But then when we'd be leaving from that scene, going to the next scene, I'd say, so I want to talk to you about what they did and why they did that. And let's, you know, and all of a sudden I was like, man, communicating with the actor about why things are happening and having the education I had from Michael about breaking down a script, sure. I was able to talk to them when they'd say things just very offhand, like, mm-hmm. well, why does she say this? Or, well, why does he do that? I'd go, well, I don't know. But I have a feeling I've thought that same thing, and here's what I think the answer will be, but you can ask Michael. And then I would just have those conversations. What's your character going through? Mm-hmm. What's your character's, you know, arc this week? What's your journey? Why are you feeling this way in this scene? What happens in the next scene? What happened in the scene before? And it was through those moments that I was like, if I can grasp camera, I think I could do this. And so I did my very first episode on Girl.
How many did you do?
I only did four. Okay. I think Ben ended up doing somewhere between 10 and 12. I only did a total of four.
And then you went on to do other shows too.
I did.
Because I've heard, you know, Sally told me.
Aww.
She said, I remember we were talking, I said, I heard Danielle's director. She goes, oh, she's amazing.
Aw, that's very sweet. Really, so that's Sally Steiner, the casting director, who then did end up casting me on Boy Meets World, was the casting director on the show I went on to direct after Girl Meets World, and was the casting director on Girl Meets World. So what a full circle moment. Mm-hmm. The woman who cast me as Topanga, who gave me this job, now sees me as a director and is the casting director for the shows I direct. But after, you know, leaving Girl Meets World, I had those four episodes, and I thought, now I just have to take this very seriously, and I have to go out and take meetings and try to get these jobs. Boy, was that more difficult than anything I had experienced as an actor.
In what regard?
People were like, yeah, you did four episodes of Girl Meets World, the show you were the star of. It was a home game. We get it. It's fine. Not saying you didn't do it, but, you know. No one's going to let you fail.
Right, exactly.
You were super supported. And there's a lot of actors who want to be directors, but that doesn't necessarily mean they know what they're doing or that they're good at it. And so I would go into these showrunners who, this is their baby. They just found out they've got a pickup order, 13 episodes from Disney Channel. And if it were up to them, they'd probably pick the person who directed the pilot and they'd say, direct them all.
Yep.
But Disney won't let you do that. They want diversity with their directors, as they should. And so these showrunners have to trust the directors that they bring on. And how much easier is it to look at a list and go, ah, Rich Carell directed 572 episodes. I'll bring him in. I'll bring David Kendall in. I'll bring all these people in that they know. Mm. Versus the star of Boy Meets World and Girl Meets World, who's now directed four episodes of her show.
How did you break the cycle? What was the next thing you got?
Well, I shadowed constantly. Right. I shadowed everybody who would let me shadow on every show.
And
that
shadowing
I could shadow
means
on.
You follow around the director on
a
show.
Yes, I would find so Steve Hafer, who had been our stage manager on Boy Meets World, was directing on Nickelodeon. I contacted Steve. Steve, can I come and shadow you? Absolutely. I reached out to executives I knew from working on Disney Channel when we did Girl Meets World. Do you have any shows where you would let me and go shadow? And I was taking meetings and I was doing literally everything I could. And one day I got a call to go meet with the showrunner, Mark Reisman, who had done Frasier and a few other things, really successful, wonderful guy. And he was doing a brand new show called Sydney to the Max. Mm-hmm. And he calls me in and I have a meeting with him, and it is like a full hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And most of these meetings, when you go in and you're hoping to get a directing job, they talk to you for about 20 minutes. They tell you what the show's about and what they think the difficult points are going to be, what they think the strengths are. They want to talk to you about your style, what you would bring to it. And that's pretty much it. This was an intense hour and a half where he was asking me technical questions, questions about my experience on Girl Meets World, telling me about the cast, and also over and over again, reiterating to me how much he believed I was capable. But this was very, this was 13 episodes and he was very nervous. And, you know, I think you could do it. I don't know that I'm going to let you do it in the first 13, but I will, you know, and I left the meeting and I thought, ah, so close. That felt really good. But like you said, probably not going to get it in the first 13. And then what I didn't know was I left that meeting and he called Frank Pace, who was the UPM on Girl Meets World, did his due diligence, tell me everything about Danielle as a director. And Frank was honest and sang my praises, said Danielle is not just a name. She's really doing it. She does the work. She comes prepared. You will not have to worry about her. And then he called Michael Jacobs and he did the exact same thing. He said, Michael, showrunner to showrunner, tell me about Danielle. Yeah. And Michael, thankfully, kindly gave me a vote of confidence. And I got word then a couple of days later, Mark's going to give you one in the first 13 and we're going to see how it goes. And the Disney executive said, I never think one is fair because it's you have so many things to learn about the cast and the crew and how this particular environment works. Give her two because you can then get a run at it and see what's possible. And so he did. He gave me two in the first 13. And I ended up directing more episodes of that show over its three seasons than any other director. I ended up doing about 16.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was remarkable. And then once Mark gave me that chance, it made it easier for all the other showrunners to say, oh, she's been doing that over at Sydney to the Max. Let's bring her over to Raven's Home. Let's bring her over to these other shows. And now I just this past year directed my first network show. I directed Lopez versus Lopez for NBC, and I'll be back with them for season two when that comes back.
That's great. So, yeah.
Must have been a hell of a learning curve to go from being an actor to then going into directing, knowing you want to do it, and basically using the same MO you did to become an actor to become a director. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a muscle you always were training and you were just executing.
Yeah. It was very similar. Harder to make that jump.
I'm sure.
But exactly the same.
The premise was the same in terms of how you approached it.
Yes. And saying to people, just coming right out and not having a hard time saying, I'll tell you where my areas for opportunity are. Mm. My areas for opportunity were with camera. And so I just, every show I went to, I would say to the camera coordinator and I would say to the camera operators, I am learning. Teach me everything. Nice. I will soak it all up. That's great. I am a sponge. Smart. I'm here to learn. And so that's been all I do.
And I think that's the attitude like a lot of young and upcoming actors or anyone who wants to break into the industry, that's the right motto to follow because you're not going to get it right away and you just never know. And you also never know who's in the room.
Yes.
Where a handshake, personality could be like, well, I like you.
Yes.
I'm going to give you a shot, right?
Yeah. I mean, or the relationships you meet with people, you all hopefully progress and evolve in the industry. I mean, David Kendall was the person who directed Sydney to the Max's pilot. Mm. And so Mark Reeson said to me, if it were up to me, David Kendall would direct all my episodes. Right. And I said, I've known David Kendall since I was 13 years old. Oh. And it's like those connections, like that made Mark feel more comfortable. Mark said, you know, David, would you come and shadow David before you direct your first episode? So sure enough, it's like meeting people, forming relationships with them, showing them who you are, having strength of character. And for David to be like, yeah, I've seen Danielle be a hard worker, willing to learn since she was a child, helps, you know, people know who you are. They can see you coming.
So so your luck you create for yourself.
Yes.
And that's what luck is. You know, if you don't create it,
yeah,
you're not going to have anything. Yep. But by virtue of being good at what you do, things follow.
Things happen. It's exactly right.
And you've done so many other things too. You have your cosmetic line.
Yeah, I have a hair care line called Be Free by Danielle Fishel, which I'm really proud of. We are a very small but mighty little team. There are a total of four of us from From product conception to your doorstep, there are four people. Wow. I work hand in hand with the lab, which is based in New York. Every single ingredient comes through me. Every single product comes through me. I test everything myself. I don't put my name on it until I'm absolutely thrilled with it. And I love it. It was when I found out I was pregnant and I all of a sudden was like, hey, I wonder what's in these products I'm using, and then found out and that's wanted something true. A little.
Oh, so that,
little,
is that what inspired the
truly
line?
Yes. I went to my very first ultrasound and heard my son Adler's heartbeat and went home. And I had kind of been a person who was like, ignorance is bliss. If it works and I like it, right, I'm going to be fine with it. And all of a sudden I heard this heartbeat and I thought, I need to pay attention to what I'm consuming. Mm-hmm. And the products I had been using were not so great. And so I didn't go like, well, then therefore I'm going to create them. Right. I just tried other more natural stuff and didn't find anything I liked. And then was like, what if
so
I just make it?
So did you develop this yourself? Or, mm-hmm. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's
cool. Yeah, I developed it myself. What I started telling people when I wanted to – when I was trying to find a lab and I was trying to figure out how I wanted to do it, I was like, listen, what I'm looking to do, I'm calling a crunchy scale. And like, let's say a 10 is 10 out of 10 bad. You know, you scan something and it's got fiery flames. It's horrible for you. And then you have the 1 over here, and that's like washing your hair with a bar of soap. I'm like a 4. I don't want the bar of soap. Right. I want a shampoo that feels like shampoo, but I don't want fiery red flames. I haven't found the 3 to 5 range that works, that has the efficiency that I am used to or the efficacy that I am used to. And how can I do that? Mm. And that's when then I started working with this lab and we went back and forth and literally every single ingredient is, you know, I am researching and looking into. And we started with a really small line. We had a shampoo and a conditioner and a scalp refresh. And the scalp refresh is really kind of a scalp detox for getting gunk off of, you know, we have a lot of buildup on our hair from products that we use. Mm-hmm. And now we have, you know, I don't know, 13 different products.
That's incredible.
And I'm really proud of it.
And in your spare time, you do a little podcast.
And then I've got a little podcast called Pod Meets World, which we're also really proud of. And
it's wonderful.
We love doing it. And we're on a live tour. We're taking some dates around the country. And that's been really fun. And
has it been interesting to see, like, what are the we're getting short on time, so I'm aware of it, Aaron. But I've been so curious. So with the Pod Meets World thing, how has your perception of the show changed? And how has I had no idea it was this popular until you guys started doing this thing. But and what is it? What have you learned about podcasts that you can tell us that would help us?
I think the number one thing I've learned about podcasts is that authenticity cannot be faked,
right,
and it can be spotted from a mile away. And so the relationships you have with each other are important to foster and to really have a good bond, because those things, people like listening to Will. Like, one of the things they say to us all the time that they love is that they really do feel our friendship through the waves. Yep. And so it's important that you foster that and that you take care of that. And it's important that you pick people and guests to come onto your show that will emit that, are going to bring in an audience that wants to hear the same type of stuff you want to do.
How do you look at Boy Meets World differently now since doing Pod Meets World?
Well, I had not watched Boy Meets World since it was on in the 90s. When it was on, I watched it every week, at least until I was 16 or 17. Once I got like a little older, I probably wasn't sitting at home Friday nights watching it. But I certainly, those first few episodes and those first few seasons, was sitting with my parents and my grandparents watching every single episode. Hadn't seen it since. So in my mind, I was like, yeah, it was a good show, but I didn't remember why it was necessarily a good show. I just had a general feeling that it was a good show. And now I watch it and it's a really spectacular show.
Yeah, I agree.
Even when you find criticisms with it, which do you do 22 episodes of something in a season?
The time period as well.
Exactly. Consideration, of course, you have to think about the fact that it was 90s. It also, there wasn't binging. Mm-hmm. So the shows weren't being watched back to back to back the way we are. So even when you have a criticism of something, I'm just blown away by how much heart and how much value and good lessons were packed into 22-minute episodes week after week.
And I think, again, authenticity. Yeah. You know, it's, we wrote about real stuff that was really going on with people at the time.
I think I'll finish on this. It's legacy as well, because what you leave behind.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've created something that you have a following for 30 years later, or how many years it is. Yeah. So that in itself speaks volumes for the show, because people still watch it. They're still interested in your characters 30 years later. So fantastic.
Fans. All the fans that are reminding you over and over again, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And how many shows can really say that? Truthfully, you can probably one to two hands that you could say of shows that 30 years later still mean this much to people. Yeah. And the fact that we got to play these characters, I mean, truly being able to play Topanga is like actors work their entire life hoping to have one character, one line that somebody can quote. And I got to play a character for the better part of 7 years that people tell me still to this day, you were iconic. You were my first feminist role model. You made me realize it was cool to be quirky, to be smart, that I could have it all. Like, those are things that are like, how could I ever top that? And to have done it as a kid and then get to spend the rest of my life being proud of it is such an honor.
That's terrific. Two quick other things. Yeah. One, we always like to ask our guests if they have a cause, a charity, a person that they'd like to mention, to give support to.
Yes, I am a national ambassador for the American Humane Association. Mm-hmm. So they are on the front line rescuing animals wherever there are tornadoes, or they work with farms to make sure they are, you know, healthy. They're the people who created the No Animals Were Harmed during the making of this movie. So I would say AmericanHumane.org.
That's great. And the last thing we do, we play this little game.
Okay.
We have this box of cards there. I'm going to try and reach it around this microphone.
Okay.
And choose one anywhere in there.
Okay.
And it's, you know, you'll get the idea. I'm sure you've played these games before. And we all answer, but go first.
Well, this is perfect.
Ooh.
Do big dreams require more luck than hard work? Explain your answer.
We just talked about
it. Do big dreams require more luck than hard work?
Hard work brings you the luck.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So that's your answer.
Yeah.
I was going to say, no, it's definitely not more luck. You have to be prepared for those moments. The luck, the luck is the opportunity.
That you create for working hard.
Yes. The opportunity presented itself. If I use just my example, I was only in the situation to be able to get that second chance opportunity for Topanga because I booked the other role I had booked.
Correct.
And
correct.
So because I had worked hard for that one, I got that. And the second opportunity came around. So you need both, but you luck doesn't, without preparation, luck doesn't help.
It bounced right off you.
Yep, it sure does.
Yeah. I would say it's the same exact thing. So I'm going to pass to Norma. I would say
I'm going to say that it also requires you conjuring up your dream, big dream.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes many of us say, oh, it's a big dream. And then you stop thinking about it.
Right.
But the more you think about it, the more you feel it, the more you visualize yourself in it, the more it actually does happen. Mm-hmm. Because subconsciously, you're looking for the cues. And subconsciously, you're seeing things almost kind of manifest. And you're following that big dream. So I would just add to that card.
Yes.
For me, I'm the same as you. You know, you work hard, you will create your own luck. If your dream is to be a director, if your dream is to produce, to whatever it is you want to do in your realm, then by working hard, you will create those relationships that you said before, your casting director.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone full circle with her.
Yes.
Because if you work hard, that will apply to everyone in life.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. And some might say Girl Meets World could have been the big dream. Look at this, getting the opportunity to play Topanga again. And had I not done Girl Meets World, I never would have been able to direct, which is literally the whole second half of my career.
There's a cause and effect. There's a ripple effect in where you are, where your presence, right? And the roads that are open up once you're there.
It's
so go for it, get all your tools, and then wait for that luck to, that moment to happen.
Yes, and then even once you think you've arrived, keep your eyes open for what other doors might open while you're there.
That's correct.
Yes. Oh, that's
amazing. That's great, Danielle. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having me.
It's been a pleasure meeting you.
So
really
nice
has
to
been
you
wonderful.
Too.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Movies With. Join us next Monday as we welcome the terrific actor and director who originated the seminal role of Dr. Joel Fleischman on Northern Exposure,
and starred in several series, including Numbers, Billions, and amazing films such as Quiz Show and Albert Brooks' comedy, Mother. Our guest next week, Rob Morrow.
Movies With is a weekly podcast produced and hosted by Norma Garcia, Rich Reed, and Jeff Sherman. Engineered and edited by Rich Evers. Graphic artist, Martin Eleben. Technical advisor, Tracy Williams. Production coordinator, Kiri Hardiman. Publicist, Josh Gershman. Social media advisor, Samantha Fox. Production assistants, Dan Waite and Alex Sherman.